This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Raymond Strother, the man who helped invent political consulting. He wrote about it in his book, Falling Up, and he's also written an accomplished novel about politics called Cottonwood. But Ray Strother, for many years, handled some of the biggest fights in Washington, 20 U.S. Senate campaigns with victors in those races, are credited to the man from Port Arthur, Texas, who is an LSU Hall of Famer and a Louisiana political Hall of Famer. We'll talk with Ray Strother about this year in politics as Democrats across the country are scurrying for cover as President Obama's popularity has faltered. Will that harm Democrats in November? The election now is just 16 weeks away. We'll talk about it. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Frank Barnett producing, and our guest is Raymond Strother. I have his books in front of me, Falling Up, How a Redneck Helped Invent Political Consulting, and Cottonwood, the novel that Ray penned in 1991, appropriately acquired by yours truly at Cottonwood Books. And the bio for you, Ray, in Cottonwood reads, Raymond Strother is one of America's top political consultants. Among his notable clients have been presidential candidates Gary Hart and Albert Gore, Senators Lloyd Benson, Dennis DeConcini, John Stennis, and Russell Long, and Governors Buddy Romer, Martha Lane Collins, and Bill Clinton. He currently lives, works, and writes in Washington, D.C. That was 23 years ago. Interestingly, yeah. The last guy mentioned was a fellow named Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time.
It is.
Yeah, that was, I'd forgotten that that's what Cottonwood said, to tell you the truth.
Yeah,
Bill, it's been an interesting life, let me say that, Jim.
It has, and you handled all of Clinton's campaigns for governor except one, I think, of Arkansas.
That's right.
And then he hired another Louisiana guy who helped him get to the White House, a guy who was a protege of yours at one time.
James Carville, yeah.
Yeah.
Great, great political mind.
Well, before we get to this year in politics, let's kind of peek ahead to 2 years from now. It looks like Hillary Clinton will be running and quite possibly will be the Democratic nominee and could be the next president of the United States. It could be Hillary as the 45th American president, or it could be Bobby Jindal or maybe somebody else. But yesterday, Maureen Dowd notes that the Clintons have done a very good job making money despite their love of public service. And she even noted that Chelsea last year got $600,000 at NBC as a reporter, and she was on the air for all of 24 minutes all year long, and she got $600,000.
I wish I had that job.
Sometimes it's good to be a Clinton, isn't it?
It really is. People in America don't mind people making money. They really don't. Many times I've been in campaigns and I've had people say, want to attack our opponent because he's a rich man or because he's outspending us 3-1. The voter really doesn't care about that too much.
Well, the other night I saw Mayor Holden out on the town, and he was commenting that he thought Mary Landrieu should go after Bill Cassidy and take a photo of his home and say, here's a man who lives in a multi-million-dollar estate who made his money off public health care and is now a big critic of public health care. So in politics, sometimes we have epiphanies, don't we?
Yeah, I don't know if that would be a good strategy or not, to tell you the truth. Now, making money off health care and being a critic of health care, that's another thing. Hypocrisy is deadly in politics, but wealth isn't.
But Jerry Brown once said, I remember him telling Tom Snyder, he said, Tom, all politicians are hypocrites. It's just a matter of degree.
Well, I guess all humans are hypocrites. It's just a matter of degree. I catch myself there all the time.
Well, your son, Dane, is still extremely involved in the political consulting game, and he has the Democratic candidate in the U.S. Senate race in Mississippi, and I'm sure Dane was hoping that this fellow Chris McDaniel, the Tea Party fellow, would have been the Republican standard bearer in Mississippi, but that did not happen because of a surge in black Democratic votes lifting Thad Cochran to victory, albeit a narrow victory over Chris McDaniel. What did you make of what happened in Mississippi with black voters bailing out Thad Cochran?
Well, the Republican mainstream, Haley Barbour, the former governor of Mississippi being one, has finally realized that these extremists make it almost impossible for them to get elected in presidential campaigns. And they're looking down the road right now. And they, even in Mississippi, somebody that far right has difficulty getting elected. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to come up with candidates around the country who are more moderate, more reasonable people. And this was a case where Haley Barbour literally had to go in and take over, and he was able to persuade enough African-American voters that they needed something other than a Tea Party senator. It was a heroic effort on Barbour's part and on the Mississippi Republican Party's part, because they probably would have lost. My son, of course, representing the Democrat, wanted the Tea Party candidate to win. In fact, nobody likes the Tea Party more than the Democrats. We dearly love the Tea Party, and I think we should encourage them. But So it's an interesting race, because that party, the Republican Party, is fractured between its right wing and its almost right wing. There's no such thing as a moderate Republican in Mississippi anymore that I know of. And I mean, there's certainly no liberal Republican in Mississippi that I know of. So, but they're fractured, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of angry people over there. So that may work well for my son. May work well for the Democrats. We'll see. But electing a Democrat in Mississippi would be earth-shattering. It would be earthquake news, because the South is just in a position, except for Mary Landrieu, just can't elect Democrats in the South right now to statewide office.
We'll talk more about that. Mississippi, though, in the presidential election of 2012, had about 45% of its voters vote for President Obama. The African American vote there is so substantial that a Democrat really doesn't need to get very much of the white vote to win, about 25%. The problem is that they can't get 25%, but those numbers may change at some point.
Well, perhaps. You know, I keep going back to the great defeat of my life, which was in 2010. In Georgia, we had a race there, similar, where the governor, ex-governor, needed only about 25% of the white vote to get elected, and he got about 16. This is a trend in southern states. It may change, and there are still some Democrats in Mississippi, but I think that it could all fit in my library.
And your son has the daunting challenge of now running against Thad Cochran, who was called a liberal by his opponent. And today there is a story, front page in the New York Times, about one of Chris McDaniel's helpers taking his life after it was revealed he was charged with participating in this scheme to take photos, which they did, of Thad Cochran's bedridden wife at a nursing home. That has to be a new low even for political consultants who go for the jugular.
Well, I think it is, too. I think there still should be some limits on what one can do. I was in a race in Mississippi a long time ago, and I won't get into particulars because I don't want to embarrass anyone, but some photos were pushed under my hotel door while I slept, and I don't know if they were manufactured photos or not, but they were of our opponent with male hookers. And I didn't use them. I just think that's a step too far. You can't give away everything in you for an election victory. And my candidate agreed with me, incidentally. So, but that's been going on a long time. That was in 1983. It's been going on a long time, and unfortunately, it seems to be getting rougher and rougher out there, and more, I'm pleased that I'm retired.
All right, so the opponent, who I believe won, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
You had photos of him with male hookers?
More explicit than that.
And you did not use them?
No, I did not use them. But I took them to my candidate, and my candidate would not look at them. And I agreed with my candidate, and the candidate said, no, we would rather not get elected than use something like this.
And that particular candidate you're referring to, he went to his grave denying this, and you say you had photographic evidence.
Oh, yeah, we had hard evidence. And they were actually used later. That was in a Democratic primary. And later, a consultant named Dick Morris actually used the pictures to help a Republican candidate he was representing.
In the next election, right?
Yeah.
You and Morris, of course, worked with Clinton.
Yes.
Had at least one memorable night with him in the governor's mansion in 1990. That one didn't turn out so well, did it?
No, it didn't. It was a bad time. Clinton was very tormented at the time. He was playing Hamlet. He couldn't decide whether he wanted to run for president or not, and whether or not he should promise the people of Arkansas he would not run for president to get reelected governor or not. And things got very, very heated one night, and I wasn't there when it finally happened, but there was a great altercation between Morris and Clinton that ended their relationship until Clinton's second term. And then other events took over, and Morris was out again.
Was that night also your last night with Clinton?
It was also my last night.
Must have been a bad night.
It was a bad night. It was a very bad night, and I left. I did something I should not have done. I abruptly got up and walked out of the mansion, got in my car, went back to my hotel, and went to bed. Because you know we all have limits and rules, and this squabble between Clinton and Morris was a little heated for me, and it was beginning to wash over on me. So I just got up and left.
And then you got a late-night phone call from Dick Morris, didn't you?
I did. I got a late-night call from Morris, and he said, "What should I do?" I said, "Get out of Little Rock. Get out of town," he said, but he owes me money. I said, "Get out of town." And that was the last time I ever had a meeting with Clinton. It was just in the beginning of his presidential campaign.
If not for that night, though, I'm sure he would have had you as his consultant in 92 when he ran for president.
Well, that's what I was there for. I'd been hired to work on his image, and I'd done it several years in Arkansas. They ran every 2 years in Arkansas at the time. When Clinton finally ran for president, it was a four-year term, but they ran every 2 years. And I'd been hired by Morris, incidentally, brought in by Morris, not hired by Morris, brought in by Morris, introduced to Clinton, so we could start working on his image so he could run for president. And so I'd been there a long time, and liked Clinton very much, used to spend a lot of time at the mansion. There was a little house back behind the mansion where I stayed, and really enjoyed his company, man, a great intellect, unbelievable intellect. And our late-night conversations, he didn't go to bed until about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm only good till about 11:30, but the late-night conversations were fabulous.
Well, the story and the legend is that he never sleeps, but he sleeps.
Yeah, he sleeps, and he gets up late. One thing that dictated his sleep pattern was that he was completely devoted to his daughter, Chelsea. And when she would come in from school, all our meetings stopped dead still. You might as well go on downtown to your hotel room and take a nap. Because until Chelsea went to bed at night, after she ate dinner with her family.
Yes, when she went to bed at night, we're going to take a break. And we shall return with Raymond Strother. His books are fabulous, Falling Up and Cottonwood. Falling Up is, of course, his autobiography. how a redneck helped invent political consulting. We'll talk with Ray Strother about what's going to happen in Louisiana and beyond in 16 weeks after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your local number outside our area. Call 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org online. We're visiting with Raymond Strother, the legendary political consultant, when he went to Washington by way of working for Weil, Strother, and East. Raymond was the, I guess, first or second political consultant to open a shop in Washington, D.C., and oh, how times have changed. And when you published Cottonwood in 91, I noticed one of the tributes given to the book is from none other than Roger Ailes.
It was. Roger was a political consultant, Republican political consultant, and an awfully good one. And he sat on the board of the American Association of Political Consultants, wouldn't he? But political consultants, Republican and Democrat, get along very well. We don't carry our political fights inside. And a lot of my friends, I have several friends who are prominent Republican political consultants. And that's not unusual at all that Roger would have been a political consultant friend. And when I wrote Cottonwood, he is not yet in charge of Fox News. He was at Fox. He's taken over, and he was trying to build something, which he did very successfully. But I asked him if he'd write a jacket comment, and he was happy to do so. However, when I asked him to write a jacket comment for Falling Up, he said, no, I'm head of a great news organization, and I can't be biased like that.
Can't be biased. Head of Fox.
A guy from Fox saying I can't be biased. But anyway, he's a good guy, and we don't have any difficulty. For many, a long time, for a couple of years, I did a radio show with him weekly. He had a call-in radio show. I think that's when he first owned Rush Limbaugh. I'm not sure, but we would have a. I would be on. I think Stuart Stevens, a great consultant from Mississippi, would be one of the guests. I'm not sure of that. I don't remember the other guests, but we had great lively discussions.
This year, as noted, we're 16 weeks and one day away from the November 4th election in Louisiana. Mary Landrieu, candidate you know well, seeking a fourth term. Bill Cassidy, a congressman, considered by most now to be the favorite in this race. He is running as the establishment Republican candidate. Rob Manus is the Tea Party candidate. He'll be at the press club today, as Senator Landrieu was a few weeks ago. Thus far, Congressman Cassidy has declined offers to appear before the press club. And another candidate in that race, Paul Hollis, the state representative, withdrew this morning. So it's it's down to three, Landrieu, Cassidy, and Manus. And Manus will probably finish third, but he could end up being a kingmaker or breaker.
Yeah, he really could. I haven't followed that race as much as I probably could have because I've been distracted by other things. But I still declare that Mary Landrieu will be reelected. She has too many things going for her. She has a good base. Women like her. She runs well in Baton Rouge. I haven't seen a recent poll or anything, but she's always run well in Baton Rouge, Natchez Parish, and Caddo Parish, and of course in Orleans. But I still think that Mary will triumph. It may be narrow, but all her victories are narrow because she's from Louisiana.
One of the factors in this race, among many, the New York Times reported a few days ago, and this is the kind of thing political junkies like Ray Strother eat up, is that unmarried women are the most Democratic voting bloc in the country, and about 66%. But they go to the polls in these off-year elections at a much lower rate than do married women, or married men for that matter. And the Democrats are trying to get unmarried women to show up to vote. How do you do something like that?
Well, the turnout apparatus now is so refined, much more than when I retired in 2010. They have a list, a master list, of every registered voter who is unmarried, believe me. That list is out there. And right now, as we speak, and I don't know, I don't have any inside information, but I know how things work. They're in contact with these women on a, you know, maybe not on a daily basis, but probably on a weekly basis. And toward the end of the election, they will make personal telephone calls to each of these women, making sure they turn out to vote. Usually, even by the time of day, about 2 weeks out, they find out customarily the time of day a woman votes. And as they say, she says, I'll vote at 10 a.m. Well, about 9:30, they start calling saying, have you voted yet? And these turnout operations are so sophisticated, so well-financed, it's become an integral part of every campaign. So they're working on that. And the Republicans are doing the same thing, though, with married women, believe me. The other side's doing the same thing. It comes, a lot of elections come down now to who votes. Yeah, not how many people vote, but who votes.
And married women vote about 49% for Democrats. It's almost even. By the way, married men, just 40%. But men.
That's in Louisiana, or is that
that's
a national?
That's national. National. But there's been a gender gap in politics that's growing as we speak.
Sure. Always has been. It's been a mainstay of the Democrats, is that gender gap. A lot of people have been elected because of it.
Now,
and Mary will be too, I think.
Well, okay, you're predicting a victory for Senator Landrieu. Last week on this show, Vincent Sulaco, the Democratic Party chair in Arkansas, is predicting Mark Pryor is going to win re-election, and polls show he has come back. And in North Carolina, Senator Kay Hagan is seeking re-election. All three of those Democrats are talking the talk that they're going to win. On November 4th, what do you think the result will be?
Well, I think Pryor will be elected, too. That's a state I follow somewhat because I had a long history there. I don't know about the Carolinas at all. I think both of those senators will be reelected. I'm not, you know, not coughed up, but I'm never coughed up of any election because things happen. But I think they can both be reelected. And what does this mean for the future? It means that we're going to continue to be a polarized and divided country, really is what it means. People like incumbents generally. And here's another thing that's happening right now. Healthcare is becoming popular. The new healthcare legislation law is becoming popular. I just read a long piece on that two or three days ago when I was in Houston. And Republicans, I don't know if you've noticed, if you cup your ear real closely, you don't hear them talking about it as much as they once did. They're talking about it less and less, and I suspect in 5 years they'll be talking about how they saved it. And the Democrats would have killed it had they not been there to save health care. So that issue is fading quickly. So it depends on what happens between now and Election Day.
Republicans are talking about suing the President of the United States. Would that be a prudent political maneuver?
I think it'll backfire. They wanted to impeach Bill Clinton, and they did, and they paid for it dearly at the polls. Their conservative Tea Party brethren don't have long memories, and so they know they shouldn't try to impeach the president, although they want to terribly, so they'll sue him. While at the same time, they talk about litigious society. So it's just another political ploy. It means nothing. I don't know if you can sue a president or not. I have no idea. I'm sure that. But the whole thing is it's the smoke and not the fire that matters there anyway.
Now, the president's numbers, as far as his popularity, they're low. And a recent poll here in Louisiana showed the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, at 32%. His are even lower than President Obama's. Is this a nationwide cycle where Democrats and Republicans who were incumbents are having problems, or is this is it singular for President Obama in Washington and singular for Governor Jindal as a governor of a state?
Well, you know, I can't speak for that, except that people don't like politicians right now in mass. They don't like the word politician. They don't like the institution of politics. And so if you're associated with politics in any way, you're going to have a certain built-in negative. People don't like Congress. They don't like the Senate. They don't like the House. They don't like the President. They don't like the institutions that prop this country up. And I think that's as bad as I've ever seen since 1967 when I started working in politics. I've never seen people as disgusted with the institutions as they are now, and I think that's really bad for us as a country.
When you handled Russell Long in 1980 when he was running for his last six-year term, he was challenged and heavily so by Woody Jenkins, and Woody, of course, was a conservative Democrat at the time, but I recall Bob Dole endorsed Russell Long.
That's right. That was the strangest thing, but that was a different era in American politics. These guys who ran the country, and Russell Long and Bob Dole did run the country, no matter who was president, they understood things that they had to get along. They had to get together. They had to work together. And they became very good friends. They drank together. They ate together. They entertained each other in their homes. And they knew each other on an intimate basis, and they could work it out. And I have a story someplace that about a dinner I ate with Russell Long and Bob Dole where they agreed on tax policy at dinner, and the next day it came out of committee. But those things aren't happening anymore. It's everybody's at everybody's throats now, and I think, I think it's bad for the country. Russell Long was a great statesman, incidentally, great statesman. And and so was Bob Dole, and we won't see the likes of them in my lifetime anyway.
Well, you've been on the show many times in the last few years, Raymond, and you've constantly referred to the South veering rightward in large part because of race, maybe exclusively because of race. Is that true?
Yes. Yes, Southern politics is still about race. And it's about race as much now as it was in 1940, in my opinion. I don't think we've achieved much as far as race goes. We've learned polite talk. We've learned a polite vocabulary to talk about race. But I find the public, the voter, as racist as ever. And it determines so much. And you won't find a racist in a poll. You can't poll and call someone on the telephone and say, "Are you a racist?" "Oh, no, I'm for absolute opportunity for everyone." Then you get them in the barber's chair, and everything changes when they're talking to somebody of a like mind. So I think race is the dominant factor in Southern politics. It's more than economics. It's race. Because the states that are the poorest are the most racist. It's strange how they'll vote against their own interests.
Well, it's the states also that have the highest percentage of African-American voters.
That goes without saying, of course.
297-5633, Charles on Jefferson. You're on with Ray Strother. Hi, Charles.
Yes, your comment about how things are different now. And my question is why? What happened to make it such an impasse and such rancor now? And I'll take that answer off there. Thank you.
What caused all this?
Yeah, what caused it? There are debates about that, and I've heard many debates. I've participated in many debates about it. But when I saw the declination, when I saw it really change, was 1980. There was a pent-up conservative movement, and spawned by a lot of weird things like Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged and some strange philosophies. But anyway, there was this pent-up emotion in the country behind Ronald Reagan, and Newt Gingrich was swept in, and Gingrich had the philosophy, win at any cost. And also, don't compromise. Stand on your principles. Well, you can't run a country without compromise. We wouldn't even have a constitution without compromise. And it got more and more bitter. Am I blaming it all on Gingrich? Most of it I am, incidentally, because that was sort of the opening shot, the opening volley. But I can't give you a perfect explanation of why, but one thing is race. I'm going to go back to race again. The South was completely lost because of the Voting Rights Act, in my opinion. And those edges are so sharp still to this day. Because what happens when the Supreme Court loosens up the Voting Rights Act? The next day, Southern states started coming up with legislation to restrict voting. Voter ID, one plan after another. Because if you're a minority party, you certainly don't want people to vote. You have a better opportunity with a small vote than you do a large vote, because the people who care the most vote the most.
Quelly in North Baton Rouge. Hi, Quelly. You're on with Ray Strother.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Inkster, and to your guests. How are you?
Fine.
Great. I've been listening to your commentary this morning, and much of what you've mentioned are things that I agree with. And one other factor that I would like to input is that there's been an increase of self-loathing interest and money involved in politics, in which people are now seeking power and have less interest in helping the people, their constituents, I should say. And that's just my opinion, and the fact that there's a lot of money involved in politics in which the politicians have no desire to help their own constituents.
That's an informed opinion. You're right. The great problem in American politics is money. And what happened is our communications culture changed. There was one time when I began in politics where we had three networks, and you had to get up and walk across the room and change channels. And now you have hundreds of networks. You have hundreds of ways to communicate with people, and they're all very expensive. So you have to have money. And people are literally selling their souls to people like the Koch brothers, etc., to get money, to get their message out. And it's harder to get a message out now because people are resistant to political advertising. It works, but they're resistant to it. So it takes more and more money, more and more message frequency. And so money dominates. And unfortunately, the people who contribute don't do it because they like the candidate. They do it because they need or want something. And yes, I talk about race being a dominant factor in Southern politics. Money is the dominant factor in all politics.
How important are focus groups? You said somebody in a poll will deny something, but in the barber chair they'll reveal it.
Yeah.
Do you use focus groups?
Oh, yeah, I use them extensively, various kinds of focus groups. We used mall groups. We used control focus groups. We used all sorts of research. And they're very good because what you want is you want the language of the people. And on the telephone or in polite company, you don't get it. So you have to bring them together with their peers and listen to them talk. And it's disheartening.
Some of the stuff you heard in Georgia wasn't very nice, was it?
It was awful, and I won't say those words on camera.
On the microphone. We'll be back with more from Ray Strother joining us from Bozeman, Montana. 297-5633, your number, back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We shall return to the phone lines in short order with Ray Strother, who's been with us for two segments, and now we're into segment three as we close out the hour with one of the most heralded political consultants in the history of the game, and he started doing his thing right here in Baton Rouge. He is a member of the LSU Mass Communication Hall of Fame and the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame, as is his former partner, Gus Weil, and together they handled just about everybody who was anybody in Louisiana, and then Raymond handled just about anybody who was anybody on the national scene. Hard to believe, Ray, it's been 30 years since Gary Hart almost got the Democratic nomination for president. I'm sure you remember 1984 as though it were last year.
I do, and I have trouble with that 30-year thing, too. It does seem like only a few years ago, but it's 30 years. I have trouble dealing with that.
The debates would have been quite interesting between Hart and President Reagan. It certainly would have been different than the ones with Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, Hart is a soaring intellect. You know, after he failed for his presidential bid, he went to Oxford and got a PhD, and he's written, 10 or 12 or 15 books, I don't know, on foreign policy. And he was kind of an aloof, distant man, but a great intellect. I think he'd have been a great president. And the debates between Hart and Reagan would have been very interesting because Reagan was so personal and so likable on camera. But they would have been interesting. They would have been more heavily into policy than probably the debates about, if you remember, in one of the debates, Mondale asked Gary Hart, "Where's the beef?"
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been interesting. What would have really been interesting, though, is the next race against George Bush. Had Hart run then, I think he would have beaten Bush
in '88.
'88.
But Hart made friends with Billy Broadhurst, and the rest, as we say, is history.
Well, let's not blame Billy for that. It was whole thing.
Well, Hart, I think we got to blame Hart for it, but Billy,
Hart. Hart.
But he was a guy who would have been, I think, a much more formidable contender in '84, when Mondale only carried one state, and there was a 25-year age gap between Reagan and Hart as well. And a listener notes that if Hillary Clinton and Bobby Jindal are the nominees of their respective parties in 2 years, there will be a 24-year age gap. Actually, I think the number is 26 years. No, it is 24. The listener is right. 24 years between Jindal and Hillary. Will age be a factor for Hillary Clinton?
Yes, it will be. Age is a factor in politics, particularly as our voting population gets younger, and it is. Age is a factor. That'll be one of her downsides. But anyway, you keep mentioning Jindal as presidential candidate. People really think he's going to be a presidential candidate? I can't imagine.
Oh, he's going to be a candidate.
I mean, that he has an opportunity to get nominated. Just,
well, who else
would shatter everything I know about American politics.
Who else do the Republicans have right now?
Oh, they have lots of folks who would be suitable candidates. I think their bench is pretty deep, to tell you the truth. Their problem is going to be deciding how far to the right or left mm-hmm. they want to go. And of course, they won't go to the left. To them, slightly to the right of center is left. But I can't imagine Jindal would ever be nominated.
Well, if you say suitable candidates, if it's Chris Christie, it'll be a very big suit. And Jeb Bush would be a strong candidate, but can he get the Republican nomination in today's environment?
Jeb Bush would be a splendid candidate for the Republicans because he's moderate and he could attract some independent voters. However, I don't know if he can get through the nominating process on the Republican side that's dominated so much by the Tea Party types, who are actually a very small part of America, but their voices are very loud and they're very enthusiastic about voting. So I don't know. If Bush were nominated, he would be a heck of an opponent for Hillary Clinton. Believe me, he would be a real opponent for Hillary Clinton. And I've been down in Texas, and down in Texas they talk about Perry, you know, of course, like you're talking about Jindal, and that he's remaking himself. But
there's a lot of remaking to do.
Yeah, I don't think Perry. I have a great story about Perry. Not great stories about Perry. Perry was a friend of mine. I worked for Lloyd Benson in his Senate races and in his vice presidential race. And so did Perry. Perry worked for Benson. And he and I would go eat Mexican food. I had an apartment in Austin at the time, an office there. And we'd go eat Mexican food about once every 2 weeks and laugh and I never thought he was that interested in politics. it's strange. He was a nice guy, and he was a lot of fun to drink beer with and eat Mexican food. But I'm surprised that he's gotten this far in American politics.
HB in Denham Springs, you're on with Ray Strother. Hi, HB.
Good morning. Mr. Schrader, I've read many times in many different articles published by many different publishers that the news media alone, whether they be radio, television, or newspapers, can make or break any candidate running for an office, whether local or national, or re-election, local or national. Your opinion on that, please, sir. Thank you.
Well, you're hitting at the heart of what I care most about, and that's the news business. I think we can't have America without the news business, and it's the single most important component in democracy, an informed public. And this idea that the media is terribly biased, there are some biased media out there. For example, I must say it, you know, straight out, Fox News is a biased network. But generally, newspaper people I've known, and those are the people I drink with, eat with, I'm godfather to their children, etc., through the many, many years, I find them very, very objective, and I know they work really hard not to inject themselves into their own opinions into anything. For example, two of the best political reporters in America that I know, and I won't mention them by name, refuse to register to vote because they think that will bias them. And this is not uncommon. My great friend and a friend of this program, Jack German, died. Jack had, as a reporter, you could never tell if he's a Republican or a Democrat. His big hero was Baker, who just died. But Jack, when he wrote his books, he could express himself. But as a newsman, he was always, always careful not to try to take sides in an issue. So the media, yeah, there's some downsides to media. There's downsides to everything in the world. But my God, I can't imagine America without its media.
Yeah,
that's my sermon.
And Jack German was the gold standard. He died 11 months ago today, and I miss him, and I know you were one of his closest friends.
Right, and I miss him every day. We talked all the time, particularly about horse racing. And I want to recommend a book. It was published after he died. You can only get it on Amazon. I think it's one of those digital books. It's fiction. It's called A Small Story on Page 3. If you want to know what the newspaper business is about now, read that novel. Then you'll understand the conflict between corporate ownership and newspaper men. It's fabulous.
By Jack German. A Small Story on Page 3.
Right.
Daryl Hunt writes, several polls conducted earlier this year in Louisiana produced results on some questions that were rather surprising. 53% of respondents favor outright legalization of marijuana. Another 60% support laws to prohibit housing and employment. Actually, 80% employment discrimination against gays. And 80% say global warming is real. And a majority of Louisiana citizens support a woman's right to an abortion in the first trimester or in cases of rape and incest. Does your guest, Ray Strother, think there is a seismic shift in public opinion in Louisiana that is not yet felt at the State House?
Yes, I do. That's a very good question. And yes, I do. I think there's a seismic shift all over. The biggest one, I think, is the gay marriage shift that I've seen. I read commentary this week someplace. I was kind of in a place where all I could do is read for about a week. And I read commentary about evangelicals now are embracing gay marriage. A lot of the evangelical community. That's been a shift it's the fastest change I've ever seen in my life. You know, people like Normal have been trying to legalize marijuana for decades. I mean, 50 years, 40 years, whatever it is. And marijuana is now being legalized here and there, and probably will continue to be legalized in a lot of states. For example, in the state I'm in now, I look outside, but Montana, medical marijuana has been legal here for several years, and it's used in cancer support groups here and everything. But, yeah, there are some changes coming, and part of it's generational. Young people don't vote well, but if they voted well, they would be voting on these issues. But remember who votes. The older you are and the richer you are, the more likely you are to vote in this country. That's just unfortunate, but it's true. That's why Democrats have to work so hard to get unmarried women out to vote. They don't have the money. And uh, they're they're lower income people generally, and lower income people vote less frequently.
Mm-hmm. Next year, we have a governor's election in Louisiana. Bobby Jindal cannot run for a third term, and even if he could, he would be an underdog. But David Vitter is running, Jay Darden is running, State Representative John Bel Edwards is running, Jim Bernhardt may run, Mitch Landrieu may run. What do you think?
I think that's a field of outstanding candidates is what I think. I think Louisiana is going to field and get some interesting ideas in that group of people. You know, I would have my favorites, of course. I think Mitch Landrieu is a great guy, and I think he'd be a fine candidate. But then, I hate to admit it, I've always liked Jay Darden. I always thought he was a very reasonable man. So Louisiana may come out very well in that governor's race, better than they are now, I suspect.
You know, we had a guy named Donald Trump here in town a few weeks ago. He, of course, owns the Miss USA pageant, and it was held here in Baton Rouge, and he sat beside Mayor Holden and Lieutenant Governor Darden. Yesterday I saw in the paper where the Lieutenant Governor was boasting, very pleased that he had received a handwritten note from Donald Trump.
Amazing.
Donald Trump, is he a buffoon?
He's a buffoon first order. I can't imagine he's completely irresponsible in almost everything political. And I think he's good for a laugh. I don't think America takes him seriously anymore. I see that the Trump casino is going broke, bankrupt in New Jersey right now. And there was a rumor one time that he was demanding to see the president's birth certificate, that we should demand to see his financial statement, because there are some people who think it may be upside down because he borrows a great deal of money and spends a great deal of money. And there are people who think that maybe he isn't quite as rich as we think. But I do think he's a buffoon, and I don't think people take him seriously anymore.
Well, Lieutenant Governor Darden, who, as you say, comes across a very reasonable man, and I think he is, perhaps he should quit bragging about his friendship with Donald Trump. You know,
if I were Darden, I would stay away from that as fast as I could. But I don't want to give advice to Republicans, even if they offered to pay for it.
Who controls the Senate next year? After the votes are counted come December, when Mary Landrieu will probably be in a runoff with Bill Cassidy, when all is said and done, who has the majority in the Senate?
I think, without going into specifics, I think Democrats have the majority about maybe one vote or two votes. It's going to be very, very tight. I think the House will go even more Republican. I think they'll pick up a few seats. Because of the way redistricting has happened all over the country, there are districts where you can't elect a Democrat at all anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it'll be more, the House will be more Republican, and the Senate will be even narrower than it is now.
A listener notes, based on my acknowledgement of you in the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame in Winfield. Howard Baker is not in there, and I didn't know this until he died. Did you know he went to Tulane University?
Yeah, I did. You know what? What's funny is, as I say, my friend Jermon, your friend too. I know you had a relationship with Jermon. One time, in an unguarded moment between races at the racetrack, Pimlico, we were sitting there. And I asked him, who is the best politician you've ever met in your career? And as you know, Jack has written many books about presidential campaigns. On. He said Baker. He said Baker was the great unused resource of America. And Jack was a liberal Democrat, but he said Baker was the very best.
I also didn't know until he died that when President Nixon, who, of course, Baker was later involved in the hearings that resulted in Nixon's resignation, but Nixon offered him a Supreme Court position, U.S. Supreme Court, when Baker was all of 43 years old, and he said, let me think about it for a day, and he talked to the Attorney General John Mitchell the next day and told him, I really don't want to do this, but I will do it if the president insists. And Mitchell said, well, we don't want a reluctant justice. We're going to go with Bill Rehnquist. Imagine how imagine how the court would have been changed if Baker would have been on it rather than William Rehnquist.
Yeah, a really balanced person like Baker would have been something. I didn't know that story. That's a fabulous story. And was Nixon trying to bargain for a vote in his favor on the
This was before the Watergate scandal. So I guess he really thought.
Well, I think everybody in the political class and in the journalism held Baker in very high esteem. I've never seen many detractors.
Well, at least posthumously, since he went to Tulane, he certainly should be in the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame. Howard Baker.
He should.
Great senator from Tennessee. Well, Ray Strother, thanks for spending an hour with us, despite a flat tire not so long ago. And
that's no way to come into town at midnight, is it?
Well, good to hear your voice, and
thank you.
Let's talk soon.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye. We'll be back tomorrow for Frank Barnett. I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.